Welcome to this deep dive. If you are joining us today, you likely spend a fair amount of time thinking about the frameworks that govern human behavior, the systems we build, and, you know, how we justify the choices we make.
Right, the really big questions.
Exactly. And today we are looking at an absolute masterclass on this exact subject. We've got a fascinating lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes of Wheaton College. It's titled Ethics Since Logical Positivism. And okay, let's unpack this. Our mission today is to explore a wild intellectual journey.
Yeah, it really is a journey.
It is. We are looking at what happens when the very concepts of right and wrong are pushed to the brink of extinction by a really rigid scientific movement. And we are going to trace the brilliant, sometimes quirky ways philosophers fought to rescue human morality.
To really appreciate that rescue effort,
we
have to establish the baseline of just how bad things got. In the early 20th century, this movement known as logical positivism had an absolute stranglehold on philosophy.
Which is putting it mildly.
It is. I mean, they didn't just critique ethical systems. They tried to pull the rug out from under the entire discipline.
Mm.
They were heavily influenced by the hard sciences, so they established this brutally strict rule called the verification principle.
Right.
They argued that if a statement could not be proven empirically through sensory experience or proven logically like a math equation, it was cognitively meaningless.
Which worked perfectly well for physics or chemistry, but it creates an immediate crisis when you apply it to human behavior. You have thinkers like A.J. Ayer who took this positivist rule and created what was called the emotivist theory.
Mm-hmm.
Ayer claimed that when you say something like stealing is wrong or war is shameful, you are not actually making a factual claim about the universe. Because you can't put wrongness in a test tube. The statement has zero cognitive content. You're just expressing an emotional reaction.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It's essentially a psychological grunt. Under logical positivism, saying stealing is wrong is indistinguishable from just wincing in pain or yelling boo stealing. It doesn't describe an objective reality. It only describes your subjective psychological state.
Which is terrifying if you think about it. I want you, the listener, to just imagine trying to live in a world where moral judgments literally mean nothing. How do we build a society on that?
You really can't.
You can't. If the statement murder is wrong is nothing more than an emotional preference, the whole architecture of justice collapses into just sentiment. It's an epistemological dead end. But, and here's the good part, this is where the pushback begins.
The resistance, basically.
Exactly, the resistance. Philosophers refused to accept that morality was meaningless. There was this robust counteroffensive called intuitionism, championed by people like G.E. Moore and W.D. Ross. They argued we have an intuitive recognition of moral truths.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, there is a really critical difference in how Moore and Ross established that intuition. Moore believed that what we intuitively recognize is the good. That connects to outcomes, much like John Stuart Mill's philosophy.
Right, focusing on the results.
Yes. But Ross took a different path. He believed we intuitively recognize the right. This aligns with Immanuel Kant's philosophy, focusing on duty and the actions themselves, regardless of the outcome.
And Ross has this great concrete example to illustrate this. He says, think about entering into a contract or making a promise. The second you make that promise, you intuitively recognize a trailing obligation to fulfill it.
You don't need a lab experiment for that.
Exactly. You just know it. Fulfilling your obligation is a recognizable standard of what is right. But as intuitive as that is, it wasn't enough to totally break the positivist stranglehold. The real breakthrough came when philosophers started playing with language itself.
This is the ordinary language analysis movement.
Yes, and it's such an elegant pivot. Instead of arguing about invisible moral realms, they just looked at the words.
R.M. Hare is the key player here with his theory of prescriptivism. He realized the positivists were treating all language as if it were an indicative, factual statement. But moral language isn't describing something, it's prescribing something. It's an imperative.
So it's not saying stealing is a wrong thing.
Right. It's the command, don't do it.
Which completely evades the positivist demand for scientific verification. You don't need to empirically verify a command. But here's where it gets really interesting. John Searle stepped in and offered an exact logical proof for deriving an ought from an is.
Which was considered impossible for centuries.
Totally impossible since David Hume. But Searle uses descriptivism and this simple $5 promise. Let's walk through the steps because it is so satisfying. Step one, Jones says, I hereby promise to pay Smith $5. That is a factual, verifiable speech act.
We can record it happening.
Exactly. Step two, it logically follows that Jones promised to pay. Step three, By definition, the act of a promise means Jones placed himself under an obligation.
You can't have a promise without an obligation.
Right. So, step four. Therefore, Jones ought to pay Smith $5.
It's brilliant. Searle proved that a purely empirical fact, a promise, can directly create a moral obligation.
It's a huge victory. But even with that linguistic win, there was still a massive conceptual hole in modern ethics. And this brings us to the British Catholic philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe.
Her 1955 article, Modern Moral Philosophy.
Yes. She pointed out this glaring complaint. She argued that for half a century, philosophy had essentially conspired to eliminate the concept of law from ethics while still trying to use all the vocabulary of law.
Her logic was piercing. She said you cannot have a universally meaningful moral law without a moral lawgiver. If you remove the lawgiver, the moral law has no factual reference point at all. It's just floating out there.
You're just feeling obligated to the universe.
Exactly. So she advocated for a return to a natural law theory combined with divine command theory.
And that theory has three specific uses, right?
Yes. Divine command theory breaks down into three core functions. First, it's the basis of moral obligation. If you ask, why be good? The answer is God's will. Second, it's the source of moral knowledge. How do we know what's right? It's revealed.
And the third?
The third tackles the linguistic problem. It provides the actual meaning of moral terms. When you ask what the word good actually means, it references the nature of the lawgiver.
Now, all of this groundwork, the language analysis, and Anscombe's critique, it paved the way for this absolute golden era. We saw a 20-year explosion in what's called normative ethics.
The heavyweights of Harvard.
Yes, yeah. The Harvard showdown. You cannot talk about this era without John Rawls.
Rawls redefined everything with his contractarian approach. He asked us to imagine setting up society from behind a veil of ignorance.
I love this concept.
It's so powerful. Behind this veil, you know absolutely nothing about your future status. You don't know your wealth, your health, your position in society. Rawls argued that from that blind spot, society would logically choose to distribute benefits equitably.
And any inequalities would have to specifically favor the least advantaged. It's an incredible systemic approach. But right down the hall at Harvard, you had Robert Nozick publishing Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which was the polar opposite view.
The ultimate counterargument.
Completely. Nozick argued for ethical egoism and pure acquisition rights. He said you have the moral right to acquire whatever you can as long as it isn't stolen or gained by fraud. The text even notes how this heavily influenced the individualism of Reaganomics later on.
Now, it is crucial to state here, for everyone listening, we are not taking sides between Rawls' liberal, equitable approach and Nozick's conservative, individualistic approach.
Absolutely not. We are just reporting these fascinating frameworks. They basically mapped the entire modern political debate, and they were literally debating it. The source text has this amazing anecdote about a law class at Harvard.
About the classroom story.
Yes. Imagine being a student in this class. The professor is up there discussing Rawls and Nozick. Suddenly, a voice from the back of the room interrupts to correct a detail. The students turn around, and it is John Rawls himself sitting in the back row.
That alone is amazing.
But then another voice from the other side of the room interrupts Rawls. It's Robert Nozick. The two of them just end up debating their theories live right there in the classroom.
What an unbelievable time to be a student.
Right. But while they were debating macroeconomics, you also had the Kantians making huge moves.
Alan Gutworth is a standout there. He focused on the principle of generic consistency, which is essentially respect for persons. He argued that if you want maximum freedom for your own life project, logical consistency demands you respect that exact same freedom for everyone else.
It's just beautifully logical. Mm-hmm. But the most surprising story of the Kantians has to be Alan Donegan.
That story is incredible.
It blew my mind. Donegan wrote this massive book, The Theory of Morality. His entire goal was to prove that the Judeo-Christian ethic was fundamentally true based purely on secular Kantian principles.
And he succeeded in his argument.
He did. But here is the kicker. He finishes the book, sends it off to the printer, and then he has this epiphany. He realizes that if the ethical output of the tradition is logically true, the underlying theology is probably true too. He actually converted to Christianity after the fact.
He literally reasoned himself into a conversion.
The power of logic.
Yeah.
But okay, as we move into the later part of the century, we hit another massive shift.
What's fascinating here is the entrance of Alasdair MacIntyre.
Up
until now, everyone, Rawls, Nozick, Gilworth, they were all focused on rule-governed decisions. What actions are right or wrong?
MacIntyre shifts the entire focus away from rules and brings back the comeback of character.
Yes, virtue ethics. In his book, After Virtue, he points out a massive historical shift. The ancients cared deeply about character, but the 18th century Enlightenment threw that out and shifted entirely to rules.
McIntyre uses this brilliant comparison between Sparta and Athens to show why character matters more than rules. He contrasts the Homeric ethic, which built Sparta, with the Socratic ethic, which built Athens.
The Homeric ethic was aristocratic. It focused on beauty, physical strength, and honor.
And the Socratic ethic focused on justice, friendship, and reverence.
Exactly. And what's crucial is that McIntyre didn't look at the Homeric ethic and call it mathematically wrong. He called it inferior, based purely on the society it produced.
Because the ultimate goal of virtue ethics isn't following a rule book. The ultimate goal is human flourishing.
The full flowering of human potential.
To get there, McIntyre says there are three rival versions of moral inquiry. First, the Aristotelian or Thomas tradition, which is based on wisdom. Second, the Enlightenment tradition, based on that quasi-scientific deduction. And third, the Nietzschean tradition, which is just based on rationalizing a power struggle.
And you have to choose which tradition you are operating in because they are totally incompatible.
So, what does this all mean for you, the listener, navigating your own life? When you make a tough decision today, which framework are you using? Are you using Rawls's veil of ignorance? Are you acting out of Ross's intuitive duty? Or are you acting like McIntyre, trying to cultivate a character that leads to human flourishing?
It's the ultimate practical question. And I actually want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over. McIntyre noted that those three different moral traditions, Aristotelian, Enlightenment, and Nietzschean, they actually have completely different definitions of what constitutes rationality itself.
Wait, really? The definition of reason changes?
Entirely. So, the next time you think you are making a purely rational moral choice, ask yourself, who originally designed the version of rationality you are using? Has the way you define reason already secretly made your moral choices for you before you even faced them?
Oh, that is heavy. That completely changes how you look at your own thought process. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. It's been a wild ride through the history of ethics. Keep questioning those frameworks, and we will see you next time.